Eagle Feather was known as a generous man, as well as a good warrior. He saw that each man received one particularly good horse and two others of perhaps less evident value, but sound of foot and wind. He kept only two for himself, both good ones, announcing it as his intention to present the best of the pair to his father-in-law as a gift. This, indirectly, would be recognized as an honor to his wife Antelope, as well as to her father. Grey Horse decided there was much he might yet learn from Eagle Feather. There was a proper procedure for entering camp after a raid, a joyous and boastful fashion for a successful raid such as this one. Limping Boy, youngest of the warriors and a novice on this trip, was given the honor of going in first to announce the victory. The rest of the men used handfuls of dry grass to brush their horses and make them shine. They preened themselves using porcupine quill combs to dress their hair, tying in all their feathers. Bear had a long braid of which he was proud. He had plaited in extra hair, which he had gotten from some girl, to make it even longer. Bear again streaked black paint on one side of his face, yellow on the other. He painted circles around his wound to make it easier for everyone to notice. Grey Horse used red and black paint, putting on the wolf tracks that had turned bullets away. The singing, shouting, laughing group from the village came triumphantly up the hill, led by an elderly woman whose sons had been honored warriors and had all died bleeding. Eagle Feather led the warriors. It was custom that he choose those who had done the most and let them follow immediately behind him. Bear pressed forward, for he had the scalps, but Eagle Feather chose Grey Horse to come second. Bear and Limping Boy rode third and fourth. A merry throng formed two ragged, cheering lines for the horsemen to pass between. Bear, who lived alone, was first to turn in, placing his scalp pole in front of his lodge to be sure no one missed seeing it and knowing what he had done. Bear was as yet a bachelor. When he had a need of a woman, he borrowed from one of his brothers, who expected him to honor the custom someday when he had a young and pretty wife of his own. All along the way, Grey Horse's heart stirred to the cheers. But he felt a growing disappointment as he vainly searched for a particular pair of happy black eyes. Nowhere in the crowd did he see Green Willow. Of all people, beyond his immediate family, he was most eager for her to see his position in the procession before it broke up. He wanted her to see the sorrel horse. It ran through his mind that he might present it to her father as a gift, a token that he was putting a claim on Green Willow. Limping Boy turned off at the lodge of his widowed mother. His father had had no brother to take her to wife after her widowhood, and she was not so well favored with beauty that other men had chosen to do so out of charity. It had been left to her sons and to the generous hearts of the camp to support her. Grey Horse pulled up presently before the lodge of his uncle father, peace chief of the camp. He received a joyous greeting from his mother and his aunts and from Black Robe. His sisters smiled, proud tears in their eyes, but they stood back from him. He was a man, and sisters did not touch a grown brother lest fleshly temptations lead to incest, one of the greatest abominations the people knew. Though it was rarely done, a man had a right to kill a sister who tempted him. Grey Horse's mother quickly brought food, which he dutifully ate, though he felt no hunger. Black Robe was eager to know the details of the trip. Every so often, the elder, who no longer rode the war trail, would interrupt with an exclamation of approval. An actual father could not have been prouder than this uncle who had taken Grey Horse as his own.
Eagle Feather is a good leader, but without my son, he would not have brought back half so many horses.
Grey Horse did not argue the matter. False modesty was not a weakness of the people. If a man did not acknowledge his own accomplishments, who else would? If his deeds were not known, how would he acquire honor?
My son will be known after this as a great warrior. You could lead a raid yourself now. Many young men would follow you.
The statement was not an idle boast. It was a challenge. Grey Horse's heart swelled at this tribute. Black Robe ran his fingers over Grey Horse's shield and the dent left by the soldier's bullet.
Your mother will sew you a cover to protect its medicine. You should leave it outside the camp, so that no accident can steal its power.
Many things could spoil good medicine. Grease was one enemy. The touch or even the presence of a woman in her menstrual period was almost certain to destroy power. A warrior could never be too careful. Black Robe admired the sorrel again. In a moment of pride and overflowing gratitude, Grey Horse gave it to him. He realized too late that this left him no gift worthy of Green Willow's father. He would find that venerable soul another on the raid he planned to lead. At dark, the people of the camp gathered for a scalp dance, a celebration which might or might not end before daylight. Grey Horse could remember some which continued for days, though he hardly felt that this raid and its results were of a magnitude to justify that much observance. Bear's two dark scalps were raised high on a pole. A fire was lighted, and the dancing and feasting and story singing commenced. One by one, the young men who had followed Eagle Feather were called upon to tell their stories. As his turn came, Grey Horse took pleasure from the approval he could see in the crowded circle of eager faces, the firelight and the shadows leaping back and forth among them as the fire flared and dulled and flared again. And there, in that circle, he saw at last the face he had sought. Green Willow was listening attentively. He dared not stare at her as he talked, for that might be noticed and commented upon. It was not seemly for a young warrior to make bold with a maiden under the eyes of the village. Comanche society gave the aggressor's role entirely to the girl, though even she was expected to remain discreet. Occasionally, after Grey Horse had moved into his own teepee, alone, one girl or another would come to him in the darkness of night, crawling through the low opening where the skins had been rolled up from the ground for ventilation. She would slide into the robes and initiate the lovemaking, which custom had made her prerogative rather than his. These girls had taught him much, which he was happy to learn. It was expected that he maintain the pretense of not recognizing them so that there need be no shame in the daylight. He had known them all, of course. To his disappointment, none had been Green Willow. Grey Horse almost stumbled in the telling of his story because his mind was on the girl. It came to him that he might ask some older person, perhaps Limping Boy's mother, to intercede for him and make his feelings known. The woman, a distant aunt, was always trying to do something for Grey Horse in gratitude for the help and friendship he had given her handicapped son. Perhaps he would do it tomorrow, if this dance ever ended. Grey Horse was tired. The trip had been long and the rest period short, and he had done much dancing through the night. He had his bed made on the west side of the teepee, facing the flap, so the rising sun would touch his eyes when he awakened. His mind raced like a runaway horse, touching on one memory and another as he relived the evening and its praises. After a time, he dropped off to sleep. He awakened suddenly to the touch of a small, warm hand that gently stroked his face. His eyes opened quickly to darkness, though he could see the form of the girl who leaned over him. Her breath was warm on his cheek as she lay down beside him. He lay quietly, letting her start. She was unpracticed and unsure. His patience and reserve did not endure. The wanting surged in him. He grabbed her in his arms and turned over with her. This was, finally, Green Willow. She would have to leave before dawn so that she would not be seen making her way back to her own family's teepee. But there was as yet no sign of light through the open flap. They lay in each other's arms, whispering. He made no pretense of not knowing who she was.
If someone else comes and ties horses at your lodge, turn them loose and drive them away. You will be my wife, and no one else's.
That is for my father to decide.
My father says if I lead a raid, many young men will want to go. I will bring back many horses and give my share to your father.
Am I worth so many?
All I can find. And more.
My father is getting old. He wants a son-in-law who will bring meat to the lodge and keep him rich in horses. He will not wait much longer.
I will begin looking for warriors today.
Then I will see that he waits, at least a while. Do not be too long, Gray Horse.
She snuggled beneath him again. He knew he would not want to be away from her a day more than would be necessary for him to find and bring back the best horses this camp had ever seen. More and more, Gideon enjoyed scouting expeditions far from the fort. Despite its relative comforts and the dependability of its plain but ample food, garrison life tended toward numbing monotony day after day. Over and over, he went through the same tiresome drills. On post, he felt more mule than man. Scout detail was different. True, the riding was long and bone-wearying. Meals were sometimes cold, often postponed, and occasionally missed altogether. Water from a canteen frequently substituted for coffee from a cup, and at times even the canteen went empty. But never did he suffer from monotony. Every hill he climbed spread a fresh and different scene before him. It was not a planned and ordered land, with houses and fields and well-defined roads, but a new and unspoiled country with a random scattering of creeks and rivers, of mountains and prairies, violated only by a few twin-rut military roads, sometimes hard to distinguish from the buffalo trails that led the way to water when there was any. Sometimes Gideon had the feeling that he had set foot there the day after God had finished it, for man had made little mark upon it. The Indian neither built nor tore down, and the white man, for the most part, had not yet claimed it. Somehow, after that second skirmish with the Indians, his fear for this big open land had left him, but the awe remained. The country would change one day, probably soon, and Gideon realized he would play a part in bringing that change. But he could always remember that he had seen it the way it was. A week after their return from the unsuccessful chase after the Indian horse thieves, Lieutenant Hollander took Gideon and part of the company on a long scout west, first along the pecan-lined Middle Concho and the rough hills which flanked it, on beyond to the gentler land where pecan trees did not grow because there was not permanent water for their roots to rest in. They passed the last wet-weather springs and moved on to the semi-desert flatlands, which sloped gradually westward toward the Pecos River, harsh and inhospitable. Grass was sparse, and trees didn't grow at all except for a scattering of the indomitable mesquite. Gideon had heard that this thorny plant sent its taproots halfway to China and had long since sucked all the water out of hell. Great open flats were covered by low shrubs like the lotebush and greasewood. And on harder ground, up the sides of acrid stony hills, grew a wicked-looking cactus plant whose curled leaves grew in a circular pattern with the sharpness and toughness of short, bent swords. The scout Maloney called them lechuguilla. Gideon saw few buffalo beyond the head of the Middle Concho, and he reasoned that those few he saw were lost. This land seemed better suited to the stiff-bristled, belligerent little wild hog known as the javelina, whose sharp tusks could take off half of a man's hand if he were foolish enough to offer it. A trooper named Davis shot one, but tried to claim possession before it had finished its diet. He lost all of one finger and part of another. None of the soldiers would eat the pig because it had fed on human flesh. Maloney found it delicious. They followed an old immigrant stage and military road through a line of low, hostile, flat-topped mountains and into a tight pass which Hollander called Castle Gap. From the mouth of the pass, the road led down across a wide, gently sloping and arid flat toward the narrow gash that was the Pecos River. The horses were thirsty, for the only water since the head of the Middle Concho had been a wet-weather hole known as China Pond. Sergeant Nettles cautioned the men not to stop and drink from the potholes west of the gap, and not to let their horses drink from them. They contained enough alkali to kill man or beast. Maloney told a horror tale about some cattlemen named Goodnight and Loving, who had brought a trail herd this way soon after the war, starving for water from the time they left the head of the Concho. Many cattle stampeded to these inviting holes, drank of the bad water, and fell dead. The Pecos was certainly no Mississippi, nor was it like any of the three Conchos. For all Gideon had heard, he was surprised at how narrow it appeared. He could have hurled a rock across it with a sore arm. But the water was swift, and he sensed that it was deceptively deep. Maloney seemed unable to distinguish most black soldiers from one another, but he had become used to Gideon and Jimbo. He chose them to ride with him for some distance upriver, then down, looking for any sign that horsemen had crossed the Pecos in the recent past. He found none. He seemed satisfied that no Indians had been here in a while. Gideon had discovered that most white men wouldn't automatically take a whip to him if he asked a sensible question.
How do you know?
Maloney was having a patient day. He swung his arm in an arc, pointing vaguely at the river.
See how steep the banks are here? Both sides? You can't hardly get into or out of it anywhere for days' ride in either direction. Bunch of them goodnight and loving cattle jumped in off of the high bank, piled up, and drowned. Horsehead yonder is the only decent crossing for long ways, north or south. If the Indians didn't cross there, they didn't cross anywhere.
They camped the night, and Gideon found just how unfriendly the river really was. Its salty water went through him like a heavy dose of medicine. He was constantly having to drop out the next day until the malady ran its course. He was not alone. Maloney seemed mildly amused over the men's discomfort and embarrassment. He was unaffected.
You boys ain't drunk enough of that St. Angelo whiskey. It'll make you immune to anything short of strychnine.
They followed the river southeastward to its next crossing far below, where an old military and mail road led from San Antonio toward El Paso del Norte in the distant west. High up from that crossing stood the skeletal remains of an old antebellum fort known as Lancaster. They camped a night there, where a full moon accentuated all the spectral aspects of the dead military post. Some of the men did not sleep well. Gideon had no problem, except that which remained from his first encounter with Pecos River water. If live Indians had not killed him, he expected no harm from long-vanished soldiers. From Lancaster, they looped northeastward in the general direction of Fort Concho. At one point, Maloney was lost for a while, and in his casting about, he led the detail to a spring and fair-sized waterhole not on Hollander's map. It took Gideon a while to fully appreciate the lieutenant's pleasure and excitement. For himself, he was gratified at the chance to fill his empty canteen. There was ample sign that the spring had been used by Indians for at least a temporary campsite and not long ago. Hollander was meticulous in penciling the location onto his map, along with a few landmarks that would help point the way to it.
One less sanctuary.
Gideon did not want to expose his ignorance by asking Hollander, and he would not ask the grimly silent Nettles. But he had come to feel a limited ease with the civilian Maloney. When he and Jimbo were out in front with the scout, he asked his question.
What's a sanctuary, anyway?
Well, around here, it's any place an Indian feels safe enough to hide for a while and get some water or camp for the night. The more secret watering holes we can find and put on a map, the harder it's going to be for Indian raiders to disappear.
Up to then, Gideon had assumed this expedition to be a failure, for they had not seen an Indian, or even the fresh tracks of one.
This country out here is big. Some places are so hard that tracks don't hardly show. So on every scout trip, we need to find out more about sanctuaries and such and mark them down on a map. Officers' maps are about as important as soldiers' rifles. But don't you ever tell them stiff-collared Yankees I said so. I like to keep them on the defensive.
The second expedition took them up the North Concho, to and beyond the point where they had turned back on their search for stolen horses. They visited the big spring Maloney had described. From the spring, they rode northwestward for a day. A chill played on Gideon's spine as he realized they had moved into that mysterious land known as the Plains. Men talked of it in the same mystic tones they applied to heaven and hell. The horizon line appeared absolutely level, without a tree, a hill, anything to break the flatness of it. Up there, somewhere beyond the shimmering heat waves, lay some dark and hidden stronghold known only to Comanche and Kiowa. Few white men had done more than guess at what it was like, for nature guarded it even more fiercely than the Indian. Time and again, white soldiers and civilians had trailed raiding parties this far and farther, only to lose all sign of them and have to turn back when their water ran out and they could find no more. Time and again, men had come off the edge of these plains half crazed with thirst, leading their horses or leaving them behind. Somewhere there must be water, or the Indians themselves couldn't survive. But it was hidden, and nature and the Indians seemed to have conspired to keep it so. Now and again, a military scouting party would find a seep or spring not mapped before, but the secrets were yielded up slowly and grudgingly, at heavy cost to men and horses. Hollander made a wide circle, hoping to cut some sign that might lead to a previously undiscovered playa, one of the shallow depressions which would become a temporary lake after a rain. His trip was in vain. By the time the detail trudged back to the big spring, the men were afoot, sparing their horses, trying to conserve in them what little strength was left. Thirst had swollen Gideon's tongue, blurred his vision. He could see nothing except directly in front of him, and even that was not plain. It would have been a good time for an Indian party to drop down and hit the troopers, for they would have been hard put to defend themselves. Sergeant Nettles delayed slaking his own thirst until he had overseen the men, preventing them from taking too much water at first, cajoling and reasoning and booting them into drinking only a little at a time, lest they make themselves sick or worse. Gideon's reason all but left him at the first touch of water on his wooden tongue, and only the rough hands of Esau Nettles dragging him back from the edge stopped him from frantically filling his belly all at one time. The sight of the half-starved black troopers floundering, fighting Nettles to get back to the water, brought Maloney to frown in disgust. Painfully thirsty himself, he was too well seasoned to succumb to panic. The men were nowhere as near starvation as they imagined, and he knew it.
To think, Frank, that me and you went to war and fought against each other over the likes of them.
They'll toughen. Next time they'll stand more. They'll be better soldiers for this experience.
They'll still be a flock of blackbirds.
Hollander decided to camp a day at the spring. Big Dempsey complained darkly, where the lieutenant couldn't hear him, that the decision had been made for the sake of the horses, not of the men. Sergeant Nettles had suffered like the rest, but it was hard to tell from watching him. He seemed to be everywhere. He seemed to know what every man was doing every minute. He made each do his part of the cooking, the cleanup. He made certain every man stood a share of the watch without dropping off to sleep. Because of the spring's popularity among the Indians, Nettles ordered a double guard. Gideon was about an hour or so into his tour of duty when Nettles came around in the darkness, making certain every man was alert, not giving in to the fatigue and the temptation to sleep.
If I was an Indian, Ledbetter, I'd have slipped up on you and killed you.
No, you wouldn't. I heard you away over yonder, and I've had this gun on you ever since.
Gideon didn't know why, but the sergeant seemed satisfied.
Did you hear what Maloney said about us this morning?
Yes, sir.
You'd like to make a liar out of him, wouldn't you?
Gideon hadn't thought on it much, but he sensed that the sergeant had deep feelings.
I don't reckon I'd mind.
He realized that was not the answer Nettles was looking for, because the sergeant stalked away into the darkness. Gideon grimaced, wondering what he should have said. Gideon had expected that they would ride from the spring directly down to the head of the North Concho, then follow the river home. He learned once more that it was idle to try and outguess white officers. Hollander conferred with Maloney, and they made a wide, looping swing more or less southward across yet another stretch of dry country Gideon had not seen before. Not until they struck the Middle Concho did he find what he considered familiar ground. They encountered a scattering of buffalo and some antelope out on one of the wide valleys, but not once did they see any clear-cut sign of Indians. About mid-afternoon of the fourth day from the spring, they came in sight of the fort. They rode in just south of the Twin Mountains that lay several miles west of Concho and San Angelo. Jimbo declared that this well-matched, well-rounded pair of promontories reminded him of Big Ella. He laughed, but Gideon considered the remark disrespectful. The two of them, riding with Maloney, jumped a buffalo cow out of a grassy swale. Lieutenant Hollander gave chase, putting two bullets through her lungs before she went to her knees and rolled over, kicking.
Bleed her for me, Charger.
Gideon's brown horse was none too keen about getting close. Gideon didn't know whether it was the smell of blood or simply the buffalo herself that gave the animal such a severe case of the keepaways. He had to dismount and hand the reins to Jimbo, then walk the last 40 or 50 feet to the downed cow. She still kicked convulsively and tried to lift her head.
Give her more time, boy. She flings that head just right, them sharp horns will rip you from gut to goozle.
Gideon waited, his hand trembling a little. This was the closest he had ever been to a buffalo. He'd not realized how large they were, even a young cow like this one. When he slashed, gushing blood splashed hot on his hand. To his dismay, it took her a while to die. He didn't watch. He was relieved when Hollander detailed someone else to do the gutting. He figured she would go to the officer's mess. What the officer shot usually did, along with whatever the enlisted men shot in the officer's presence.
Half of her goes to the company mess.
Woo!
Even Big Dempsey looked surprised, though he didn't cheer or even smile.
According to my calculations, the paymaster should have come and gone. If so, that means we're due to be paid when we get in. Now, I'd hate to know that any men of my company did anything so foolish as to go across the river tonight and get drunk. So whatever you do, don't tell me about it.
Sergeant Nettles frowned.
Surely the lieutenant don't mean to encourage these men to drunkenness and sloth.
Hollander winked at Maloney.
As I told them, that's the last thing I want to hear about.
Gideon had never lost time worrying about the fact that he couldn't read or write. Few black people he had known could. Those few had usually made him uneasy. Intentionally or not, they seemed always a little superior. The way house help had always looked down on the field hands. He had tolerated his subordinate position to white people because he had been born into the custom. Acceptance had been drilled into him from as early as he could remember by both whites and blacks, with words, looks, with a cane, a few times with a whip. He didn't like it, and occasionally he had flared up against it at considerable pain to himself. But usually he had stood it, as he stood bad weather and mud, bad water and bad food. It was life. A man came to terms with it. But he did not appreciate other black people making him feel inferior to them. He had always resented and resisted. The situation came to a head at the pay table. The men just in from the scout lined up for their pay, signing a receipt as the adjutant counted out greenbacks and coin. Like the other soldiers, Gideon scratched an X. Sergeant Nettles stood beside the table to keep order. He had only to be there, his frown, his brittle and wicked eyes silently putting every man in his proper place. He had not spoken a word to the other men, but he spoke to Gideon.
Ledbetter, is that the best you can do?
Gideon had stood quietly in line. He had not made any commotion or crowded anybody. Big Dempsey had done both, but Nettles had said nothing. He had only given the trooper a cold stare that would wither a cactus in full bloom, and Dempsey had gone on his best behavior. Gideon's resentment began to stir. Why was it that no matter who aroused his displeasure, Nettles always seemed to light on Gideon alone? Nettles jerked his head in summons and walked to one side, out of earshot. He turned, his eyes cutting like black steel.
You enjoy being backward, Ledbetter? You want to be just another ignorant nigger the rest of your life?
Anger leaped into Gideon's face. He had to clench his teeth to keep from answering Nettles in kind. To him, ignorant meant stupid. He knew he was not stupid.
Ain't you ashamed to sign your name with an X?
Gideon hadn't thought about it one way or the other.
Well, everybody does.
I don't. White soldiers don't, most of them. Ain't you as good as a white soldier?
Gideon hadn't thought much about that, either.
White folks don't think so.
I ain't asking white folks. I'm asking you. You telling me you ain't as good as a white soldier?
Gideon's face was hot.
How come he always picks on me? I ain't a-saying that.
Then you're saying you're as good as a white soldier, huh?
Gideon looked around quickly to see if any officers could hear. They wouldn't like the tone of this.
I am.
You ain't, if you can't read or write your own name.
Gideon looked at the other men waiting in line. They couldn't do it either. Why didn't Nettles jump on them?
Well, nobody ever taught me how.
If a man wants to learn bad enough, he can teach himself.
The longer Gideon considered that, the less sense it made.
Well, how can a man teach himself something he don't know in the first place?
A man with gumption can do anything he sets his mind to. You want to learn, Ledbetter?
It was less a question than challenge. The way it was put to him, Gideon's pride would not let him back away.
Yes?
Almost immediately, he sensed that Nettles had baited him into a trap. A half-grin fleeted across the sergeant's leathered face, then was gone just as quickly.
Remember, you volunteered. I believe you're acquainted with Chaplain Badger, hmm?
Every Sunday that Gideon had been on the post and had not been standing duty, he had attended Badger's services. Faith had been drummed into him from as far back as he could remember, by his mother, by Big Ella, even by old Colonel. Slave owners, by and large, had always encouraged religious teaching among their chattel, especially those parts that dwelt upon obedience.
Chaplain Badger gives classes of a night. Now, I'd be going, and if you got any pride in yourself, you'll go too.
Gideon frowned, looking at the pay line.
Tonight?
Tomorrow night. Brother Badger is a servant of the Lord, but tonight's the devil's night to preach.
He stared morosely at the pay table. Already paid, Jimbo waited uneasily for Gideon. He pointed his chin toward Nettles.
You been up to something I don't know about?
Gideon shook his head.
He wants me to go to Chaplain Badger's night learning. He wants to learn me to read and write.
What for? You ain't got nobody to write to?
I don't want to do it by myself. I wish you'd go with me, Jimbo.
Jimbo jingled his newly acquired wealth in his pocket.
Tonight?
Tomorrow. Ain't gonna be much learned tonight.
Jimbo smiled. His eyes sparkled with mischief.
Tell you what. You go with me across the river tonight, and I'll go with you to the Bible learning tomorrow.
From where he stood, Gideon could see the part of the sprawling line of buildings that made up the principal business district along Concho Avenue, parallel to the river. From this side, the view was of back doors and fluttering clotheslines, of outhouses, of trash heaps that strung themselves halfway down the riverbank. St. Angela had not yet felt the stirrings of civic pride that insisted on hiding the unsightly. That would come later with the better sort of people. As yet, the town existed principally upon the spillage from the fort. And what did illiterate black soldiers know of civic pride, or of pride in any form? Folks said St. Angela was good enough for who it was for.
All right, but I ain't taking more than $3-4 with me. When that's gone, I'm coming back.
$3-4 would be like water spilt on a hot stove.
Then I'll get to bed early.
Not since last payday had Gideon mustered the nerve to go back to Old Woman York on Laundry Row. From the stables and corrals, he'd occasionally caught a distant glimpse of Hannah York bending over the wash tubs or struggling stoop-shouldered with buckets of water on their way to the blackened pot or from it. Invariably, her granny would be nearby, like some shriveled old witch stirring her cauldron. Occasionally, Gideon saw the girl at or near the colonel's house, but there, too, she was out of bounds. A common soldier did not tread in the vicinity of the officers' houses unless on business that could stand close inquiry. The married officers had a constant dread of black violation against their womenfolk, a conviction that the animal drive was strong among Negro troops, that none could be trusted where white women were concerned. Carrying his dirty clothing, rolled and tied by shirt sleeves, Gideon at last had a legitimate excuse and the money to back his claim. He suspected the old woman would compromise her suspicions in the interest of coin, if the white people across the river could compromise their racial feelings in the same cause. The girl saw him before her granny did. She paused for a moment from scrubbing clothes against a washboard. Her even white teeth were shining in a broad smile, and the sight lighted a glow to warm him like a bright lantern on a dark night. The officers could keep their pale, washed-out, blue-eyed wives. This girl was, hands down, the prettiest feature Fort Concho could offer. When the old woman stopped rubbing clothes and looked up from a steaming tub, Hannah York quickly turned her face away so her granny could not see her. Gideon's long shadow fell across the old woman's tub. She brought herself slowly around, squinting painfully into the sinking sun. He guessed the years had not been kind to her wicked little eyes.
Who you be?
Name's Ledbetter. You done clothes for me once?
She jerked her head irritably.
Get yourself over this way to where I can see your face without the sun in my eyes. I can't hear a thing you say.
He realized she heard him mostly by watching his lips. He moved partway around the tub and repeated what he had said. His position let him appear to look at her while he looked over her shoulder at the girl. Hannah had not resumed her scrubbing.
How you been, Gideon?
He was momentarily surprised that she remembered his name. It had been a long while.
Just fine. How you been?
I got the misery some, but they ain't fixing to put me under the ground yet.
Hannah shook her head and spoke from behind her grandmother.
Don't answer me back while she's looking at you. She can't hear when it thunders, but she can tell what you say, long as she can see your mouth.
The old woman's eyes regarded Gideon with suspicion. She knew perfectly well that he didn't give a damn how she felt.
I was about decided you wasn't coming no more. I figured Granny put a spell on you.
Gideon contrived to turn around as if looking for the proper place to put his bundle down. The old woman couldn't see his lips.
I've been wanting to come see you. They've been keeping me busy.
I know. I seen you go out one day with a bunch of the other soldiers after the Indians. I heard later a couple of men got themselves killed. I was scared to death it was you, till I seen you over to the horse pens. I wished you'd have told me you was all right.
I didn't have no idea you was worried.
Well, I was.
Gideon's face warmed. The old woman poked at his arm. He drew instinctively away from her touch.
I told you to look at me.
I forgot. Where you want me to put these clothes at?
She pointed her thin, crooked finger at a crude wooden bench put together of warping pecan lumber, pegs, and rawhide strips.
Yonder!
He took advantage of the chance to turn away from her again.
I'd like to come see you sometime, without your old granny around.
I wished you could, but I told you she don't allow none of that.
She goes to sleep overnight, don't she? If she's all that deep, I could come up and whistle. She wouldn't hear you slip out of the house.
If she was to find out, she'd take a whip to me.
She ain't gonna find out. Not if we're careful. I'll come tonight.
Hannah was a minute in answering.
Granny's got company coming.
Company don't stay all night, does it?
Not tonight, Gideon. Please.
He had gotten farther with her than he expected, yet he felt a keen disappointment at being put off even for a night. He turned, prepared to press his case, and looked straight into the malevolent face of the old woman. She shook her finger at him.
You trying to talk to my girl? Don't you lie to me. I can smell a lying soldier as far as I can see him. I don't allow no trash messing around with my gal, you hear me? Now you get yourself away from here and you stay away when you ain't got no business. I'm gonna get me a dog, a real mean dog.
Gideon maneuvered into the setting sun.
You be listening, Hannah. I'll come whistling for you.
He left there humming to himself. If that old woman had it in her head that she was going to keep him away from Hannah, she was way off in her thinking. Among the many things the army had not gotten around to building at Fort Concho was any proper sort of bathhouse for the troops. At dark, Gideon and Jimbo and several others headed for a spot just downriver from the town and splashed around into Concho to wash off the dirt and the sweat and whatever else had accumulated on the scouting trip. A few people in town had complained about this practice and the contamination of the river. The commanding officer had always promised to take the matter under advisement, suggesting the townspeople might help by petitioning their congressman for an appropriation to build a bathhouse. The complaints about contamination from the soldiers had been generally laughed at by the men of the fort, white as well as black. Most of the people in town got their drinking water hauled to them in barrels by a Mexican who had two mules and a two-wheeled cart. Many a time he had been observed with his cart out in the river, He'd be filling barrels while his mules stretched themselves and emptied their kidneys into the current. That, some of the soldiers had suggested, was probably what gave San Angelo whiskey its peculiar kick. It was also why soldiers didn't drink water when they were in town. One reason, anyway. Jimbo had always been proud of his uniform. Even at its dustiest and most abused, and even when a harsh summer sun made it unbearably hot, it was brighter and smarter than the tattered rags he had worn most of his life around old Colonel's stable. Mirrors were few at the fort, but Gideon noticed that Jimbo seldom missed an opportunity to pass by one and smile at the image that smiled back at him. Those few times Jimbo had a chance to take himself a night in town, he went shining. Every button was buttoned, every wrinkle flattened the best he could make it. Jimbo critically pointed out any flaws to Gideon.
You got a little spot of grease on your britches down at the knee.
Gideon had little of Jimbo's deep attachment to the uniform.
They ain't gonna be put out over no spot of grease. They just gonna wanna know what's in the pockets.
What is?
$3, like I said. When it's spent, I'm coming back.
He resented spending even that much. He had rather leave it rolled up with most of the rest in a pair of socks at the bottom of his footlocker. Someday, when that sock was good and full, he was going to buy something for his own. A piece of land, or a store, or maybe a shop of some kind. He wouldn't always be a soldier. Jimbo dusted his uniform once more.
Don't matter what you look like, Jimbo. Long as you got money, you're a customer. When you're broke, you're just a nigger again.
Because the rest of the garrison had been paid while Hollander's company had been out on scout, and their wages were spent, the town was not crowded. That meant most of St. Angela's attentions were focused on relatively few soldiers, hardly an unmixed blessing. It meant the vendors of whiskey and other wares could devote more time and surface-smiling assistance to each individual in helping relieve him of his earnings, rather than run everybody through en masse like cattle at the slaughter. On the other hand, it gave Gideon less chance to melt into an anonymous crowd and enjoy the jollified atmosphere without investing much in it. Small as it was, that town frightened him more than the half-explored Indian lands that stretched almost to infinity beyond it. He had tasted that land now. For all its strangeness, its continuous threat of disaster, it produced a stimulation he had never known before. Out there, he seemed set free from the constraints of his blackness. The land made equal demands upon all men, and neither gave credit nor demanded extra for their color. In St. Angela, he was aware every minute of being black, tolerated only for the money in his pockets. Even when mouths smiled, the eyes showed hate. He drank beer. It was milder than the liquefied fire the other men favored. It went down slower and cheaper. The religious side of him suspected it was just as wicked. He followed along with Jimbo and Dempsey and the rest as they roamed up one side of Concho Avenue and down the other, looking into each place that offered refreshment and entertainment. Some of the men who had been on post longest offered advice about the places which watered their whiskey or were careless in counting change. They had advice about the ones where the women were likely to give the men a little something extra to take home, something they hadn't counted on and didn't want. Gideon had always found Jimbo rash about matters of this kind, and he marked it to his credit that Jimbo seemed willing to listen to good advice. Sometimes. As the evening wore on, the newly paid men were liberally scattered up and down the street. Gideon found himself sitting in an adobe-walled gin dispensary with Jimbo, Dempsey, and three others, listening to a one-legged old black fiddler make tunes of indifferent quality but commendable energy. Dempsey seemed to know a lot about the peg leg. It always surprised Gideon how much Dempsey knew about everybody, and most of it bad. Dempsey said this old man didn't even have a shack to live in. He slept in a crude picket lean-to behind the saloon. He scratched out a living by such menial chores as toting slops down to the riverbank and spilling them over the edge. At night, he fiddled for whatever small coin the customers might see fit to give him.
He'd have been better off to have stayed a slave. At least he had a roof and some proper victuals.
He's free!
Free to starve to death, looks like to me, or die of the ague from sleeping in the rain.
Dempsey looked 8 feet tall as he leaned across the table, his eyes crackling.
For a grown man, Gideon Ledbetter, sometimes you don't understand a damn thing.
Gideon settled back in his chair, smarting a little. Except perhaps Esau Nettles, Big Dempsey was the most difficult man he'd ever tried to get along with. Gideon looked away from Dempsey and concentrated on the proprietor as he slowly sipped his beer. He tried to decide what breed the man belonged to. He had the voice and manner of the southern white trash from back on the Delta, but he left no doubt that he considered himself superior to the black soldiers whose spending he depended on. Gideon shrugged. That was the way things were, and he wasn't going to lose sleep over it tonight. There had been one girl in the place when the soldiers first came in. The proprietor whispered in her ear, and she left. In a while, she was back, with enough other girls to go around, one to each man. Gideon could easily see that this meant twice as many drinks sold in the same amount of time, and the girls weren't paying for any of them. The girls of the town were mostly Mexican, a few Negro. Most of these women looked as if they could give a man more problems in 3 minutes than he could cure in 3 years. Gideon had known little of such things on the plantation, but a military barracks taught lessons of some subjects that Chaplain Badger's classes never touched upon. One of the newly arrived girls was black. Gideon was tempted momentarily, but Big Dempsey grabbed her.
Another whiskey over here, please.
In a minute, a little Mexican girl, somewhat plump, seated herself unceremoniously on Gideon's lap. Feeling foolish, he bought her a drink. She didn't order cheap beer like his. She took whiskey. Her English was broken, so he didn't understand all she said, but her busy, roving hands spoke a universal language. Dempsey soon left with his girl.
All right now.
Jimbo was dancing with a tall, lithe Mexican woman to the scratchy tune of the Peg Legs fiddle. Gideon was so caught up in what his plump girl's hands were doing that he didn't notice when Jimbo and his companion slipped out the door. Gideon's blood raced. His face was warm. He felt himself trapped in a situation he had not intended, though it was becoming frighteningly pleasurable. If he didn't bring it to an end quickly, he was going to be embarrassed right here in public. He was torn between sitting passively and running like a thief. He was not a complete novice. He had been attracted to girls on the plantation, and from time to time he and they had followed their instincts. But they had always found some remote place. It had never been a public performance. The urge to flee finally won out, not a minute too soon. He bought the girl another drink and told her to wait for him. He slipped out the back door as if going to the toilet, but when he hit the night air, he kept walking until he was across the river and on the post. Looking back, he struggled between relief and frustration. He hadn't had enough money left in his pocket to have paid the girl's price. He was tempted to go to the barracks for more money. The girl was probably still waiting for him. The coolness of the night and the passage of time subdued the urge. He adhered to his resolution to stay south of the river, though he felt a little ashamed. His thoughts turned to Hannah York, and conscience began to plague him. He was sure she would think ill of him if she knew how near he had come to sin and shame. Gradually, the frustration gave way to a sense of relief that he had not betrayed her. In a little while, he found himself standing by her shack, looking at the darkened windows. He remembered her admonition not to come tonight, but he could see no harm in it now. Obviously, the old woman's company had left. Granny York was probably asleep. Temptation found little resistance. He stood by one of the windows. The old woman couldn't hear it. He waited a little. Then he stepped closer, listening intently. The house was still quiet.
Hannah! Hannah!
Disappointed, he finally gave up. If he called any louder, he would wake up half the post. He walked away from the shack, moving back down toward the river to sit a while on the bank and listen to the voices whispering in the water. He walked slowly, aimlessly across the top of the high, rough bank, looking down at the river, a shine in the moonlight. It was no longer mysterious to him, for he had seen its headwaters and the land across which it meandered on its way to this place. From here on, flowing eastward, it moved into a relatively safe and civilized country. People lived out there. Not soldiers, but real people who had houses, fields, and cattle. People made secure by the presence of this fort and the soldiers here. Perhaps someday, when he had saved enough, he might buy a farm there and break out his own field, build his own house. If he managed to please the Lord, perhaps Hannah would share that house with him. He heard splashing. He thought at first it was the river beating against some rocks. Stopping out of curiosity, he could see someone standing waist deep, bathing. Moonlight shone on the woman's breasts. Embarrassed, he knew he should leave quietly. But the same urges which had kept him in the saloon quickly overrode his resolve. He knelt so he would not be conspicuous. At the distance, he didn't know if she was black, brown, or white. It made no difference. She was slender and female and a beautiful sight to behold. He watched while she rubbed soap over her body, then dipped under to rinse it off. She lingered, which suited him well, for he was in no hurry to go back to the barracks. The longer he watched her, the more his mind turned back to the girl in the saloon, and to wondering if he had done the smart thing in leaving. After a time, she came up out of the water. Gideon saw a towel at the edge and a dress spread on a large rock a little farther up the bank. As she dried herself, she moved toward the dress. The moonlight touched her face, and Gideon knew her.
Hannah!
She covered herself quickly with the dress.
Who is that?
It's Gideon. I didn't go to scare you.
Gideon, you oughtn't to be here.
I didn't know you was down there.
Turn your back till I put my dress on.
It was a needless gesture. He had seen about all there was.
I'm coming down.
You oughtn't to.
He found no real resolve in her tone. He picked his way down the bank and stood before her in the moonlight, a few feet from the water.
Did you follow me from the house, Gideon?
No, I didn't know you was here.
Then how come you to be on the river?
Just walking, thinking. I'd taken a bath myself along here a few hours ago. It's a good place for it.
She seemed to want to believe him.
I come down here sometimes late at night, when there's nobody around. Bath feels awful good sometimes. Seems to wash away more than just the dirt.
They stood in uneasy silence, and again her suspicions came to the surface.
You was watching me from up there.
I didn't know it was you.
You always go around looking at naked women?
He seldom had the opportunity, but he knew better than to say that.
I was brought up Christian.
Lots of people is brought up Christian, but it don't take much to turn their head.
If I'd known it was you, I wouldn't have looked.
But if it was somebody else, you would.
She had trapped him, and his face warmed. She touched his hand.
It's all right, Gideon. You're a man. Men can't help being turned that away. It's in their nature.
How would you know? You're too young.
Granny. That's why she don't let me have nothing to do with no soldiers. She says they all got the animal in them.
You think I got an animal in me?
You're a man. You did watch me from up yonder. You sure you didn't follow me?
I didn't. I went by your house. I whistled for you and called you real quiet. I figured you was asleep and didn't hear me.
You better not do that no more, Gideon. You'll get me in trouble.
A woman can't hear. She don't ever have to know.
It ain't just her. It's others.
What others?
Well, like Miss Colonel, she ever gets a notion I'm messing around with the soldier, she won't let me work in her house no more. She might even tell Mr. Colonel to kick me and my granny off this post.
Ain't nothing wrong with a man and a woman seeing each other.
They is around here.
She still had his left hand. He touched his right hand gently to her cheek.
Hannah, I don't understand this. Old Colonel back at the plantation, he was religious too. But he didn't raise no fuss over a man and a woman seeing one another. He always said there's things in nature that people can't stop and oughtn't to try. I want to see you, Hannah. I want to see you all the time.
He didn't understand his feelings, for he had never had any just like this before. He wanted to cry, but didn't know the reason for it. She laid her head against his chest.
I want to see you too, but it ain't that easy here. We gotta be careful.
He could feel the warmth of her body through the thin cotton dress. He drew her firmly against him. She did not resist. He moved his right hand from her cheek down to her chin, raised it, and kissed her lips. They were warm and soft. A sudden intoxication raced to Gideon's head. He half crushed her while he kissed her again. She seemed momentarily surprised. Then she responded. Her hands pressed against his back, and her legs pushed against his. There was no asking, no telling. It seemed as natural as breathing for him to sweep her into his arms and carry her to a grassy place beneath the steep bank and lie down with her. He crushed her again and felt the heat in her face like that in his own. Her whole body trembled. They lay locked together a long time. Finally, both naked, they went into the river and washed one another. They dried and dressed and started back to the post, arms around each other's waists. They walked slowly, wanting to make it last. From across the river came the sound of a harmonica and an old tune from years ago. He reached back into memory and the words came.
The years creep slowly by, Lorena. The snow is on the grass again. The sun so down the sky, Lorena. The frost is where the flowers have been.
Not far from the old granny woman's shack, they pulled into the black shadow of a corral and clung a while. Reluctantly, he let her go. She held to his hand until their arms were stretched. She squeezed his fingers.
I want to see you again, Gideon.
I'll be walking by the river real often from now on.
He watched until she was gone from sight, and a little longer. Body tired, but heart singing like that peg leg's fiddle, he walked to the barracks.
Dang!
He stumbled over a boot someone had left in the aisle. Jimbo raised up in his bunk.
That you, Gid?
Gideon blinked in surprise to find Jimbo and the others in bed ahead of him.
What y'all doing back so early?
It ain't early. It's up into the morning. Where'd you run off to, Gid? You missed a lot of fun.
Gideon smiled, though Jimbo couldn't see it in the darkness.
I didn't miss nothing.
In frontier army posts, the chaplain had an extra duty beyond that normally levied by God and the military. He was expected to minister to men's minds as well as their souls, especially in black units where illiteracy ran near 100% among the enlisted men because of their previous condition of servitude. It was the chaplain's duty to teach reading and writing to men who had never encountered these skills or had brushed against them too lightly to have been scratched. This was not pure altruism on the Army's part. The practical purpose of this coaching was to produce men capable of handling at least some of the endless clerical work and writing of reports in duplicate, triplicate, and quadruplicate that sometimes made the suffering of a long scouting expedition far preferable to garrison duty for field-grade officers. On as many weekends as garrison routine made possible, the chapel tent became what some on the post euphemistically called the Concho Academy, teaching black troopers how to read and write their names, and if they stayed hitched long enough, how to handle more advanced material. Gideon found a certain fascination in schooling. It had long been a source of wonder to him that one man could make what appeared to be hen scratching, and another man could glance at it and know what he said. The concept had seemed somehow akin to the dark magic that a few black people still attempted to practice as a heritage from forgotten ancestors across the big waters. But when the chaplain printed Gideon's name on a slate and told him that was the way it had always looked and would always look, and pointed it out to him on a page in his thick black Bible, Gideon had enthusiastically committed himself to learning. The chaplain slapped his hand on the black cover of the book.
You keep studying, Gideon. Apply to learning the same vigor that your biblical namesake applied to war, and you'll someday be able to read this good book yourself, from one cover to the other.
This is a mighty big book, and I'm getting a mighty late start.
The chaplain smiled.
There are children on this post who can sit down with this book and read page after page.
It was several weeks before Gideon was sent off the post on another detail. This gave him ample time to attend classes at night, which was to his liking, though Jimbo had given up after a week. It also gave Gideon a chance, after class, to slip away in the darkness to old Granny York's house. Now and again, he would find the shriveled little woman sitting out in front, her corncob pipe glowing in the dark like one eye of the devil. Nights like that were a sharp disappointment. Other nights, he would whistle and hear a soft answer from inside, telling him to wait a little. Presently, when the old woman was snoring, Hannah would come out and hurry away into the night with Gideon. He had had feelings from time to time before about one girl or another, but never had one fired his soul like Hannah. Always before, the fire had flared briefly, then burned itself out. With Hannah, the flame seemed to build higher. The wanting was never satisfied. It was always there. Days he drilled and curried horses. He quarried stone from Ben Ficklin Crossing or mixed mortar or dug ditches and pits. These were physical things that called only upon his body, leaving his mind free to be with Hannah, to walk with her by the river, to swim with her, to lie with her in the darkness. He planned their future together and tried to figure, though he was vague at ciphering, how long he would have to save to buy them a farm. Hannah had told him that was her dream, to have a little farm where they could live alone and never worry about pleasing anyone, white or black, except each other. The air was sharp with the breath of coming winter the night he found her waiting outside without his having to whistle. She had a towel in her hand. When he touched her, she seemed to draw away.
Let's go to the river. I need a bath real bad.
It's cold to be swimming. You'll take yourself a chill.
That's better than feeling dirty like I do.
You've been working too hard.
I don't know no way I can stop it.
He found a touch of bitterness in her voice that he had not heard before. He put his arm around her and felt her flinch again, drawing herself in. Angrily, he decided she had quarreled with that old granny. The witch had caned her, more than likely. It had happened before, leaving Hannah bruised and hurting.
Someday I'll take a stick to that old woman.
Wouldn't do no good. I'd still belong to her.
Nobody belongs to nobody anymore.
I belong to her.
If you got to belong to somebody, belong to me. We could get married.
Hannah missed a stride. Gideon stopped, turning back to face her. For a moment, she stared at him in hope, but the bitterness held on.
You just don't understand. I still got to do what she tells me to.
Gideon chewed his lip as they walked to the river. He thought about taking off his clothes and going in with her, but the raw wind changed his mind. He stood on the bank and held the towel and watched her walk hesitantly into that cold water. She used the soap and washed quickly and hurried back to the bank, shivering as he wrapped the towel around her. He held her against his body to give her warmth. She also gave him warmth, and his hands began to move. She caught them with cold fingers.
Just hold me, Gideon. That's all I want.
She shivered against him, and he sensed that it was not all because of the wind.
Have patience, Hannah. From now on, I ain't spending a dollar. We'll have us that farm before long. You'll see.
Takes a bunch of money to get a farm.
We'll have it.
Takes more than money. Takes a lot of knowing, too.
I already know about farming. I've done it all my life. And lately, I've been learning other things. Looky here.
He knelt and traced six block letters in the sand.
You know what that is?
Just scratching is all I can see.
Them letters say Gideon.
How do you know?
Chaplain Badger told me. He's a Bible man.
Maybe he's just putting a bunch of foolishness in your head, white men. They tell you anything to get what they want.
Chaplain's a good man. He wouldn't lie. Lying's a sin, and he's hard set against sin.
They all against sin, except when they want to do it. Then they just call it something else.
Gideon frowned. He'd never seen her so resentful.
What's got into you, Hannah?
You're just so trusting. White man tells you something, you take it for the truth. They ain't none of them you can believe.
There's a plenty good white folks, Hannah. You just gotta know them is all. There's men like Colonel Thomas and Lieutenant Hollander. He's good to the men.
His clothes ain't no cleaner than the rest of them.
She doubled her fist.
Wait till something don't suit him. Then you'll see what the other side of his face looks like. This is their world. We're just here to do what suits them and nothing else.
She pulled out of his arms, unwrapped the towel, and put on the freshly washed clothes she had brought.
We better get back. It's cold out here.
It is, in more ways than one.
He walked with his arm around her waist, but she did not cling to him. Even as they moved side by side, she seemed to be putting distance between them. He sensed that the underlying cause was not of his doing, and he felt a momentary resentment for being the victim of it. His silent message seemed to reach her. As they paused in the shadow of the corral where they usually took their good nights, she turned into his arms.
I didn't go to take everything out on you, Gideon. You ain't done nothing. You just wait a couple nights before you come back to see me. Everything will be all right by then.
Couple nights can be an awful long time.
A little waiting makes things better when they do come. Everything will be back like it's supposed to be for us.
She hurried into the moonlight. He watched until she was out of sight and listened to be sure the old woman didn't awaken and raise a ruckus, though he didn't know what he could do about it if she did. His mind was a whirl with confusion. He had never imagined things could turn so contrary-wise with a woman.